This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it is all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, as always, happy to have you in the starting gate with me for the next hour on Sirius 216, XM 204, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and available anywhere you access your podcasts each and every week. Well, so many of you have reached out to tell me how much you really enjoy our I Ask, They Answer segments, which are included on our Saturday morning Equine Forum show. And by the way, those are also made available as a standalone podcast each week following that show. So you can listen on our website or wherever you're getting your podcasts. But one of the things that helps make that segment so popular is the sometimes bigger-than-life presence of trainer Dale Romans. And one listener even went so far as to say that he would love to have Dale over to his pool party for a couple of drinks and some racing conversation. And it is that polarizing personality and the brutal honesty when talking about the sport that makes Dale Romans such a popular figure in racing circles with both fans and with horsemen. So today, here on Trainer Talk, I'm going to take you inside the Romans Empire with a full hour of horse racing conversation, as I once again get to say welcome to my good friend, trainer Dale Romans, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Dale, appreciate the visit.
Hey, you know you can get me anytime to talk about horse racing.
Why do you think racing fans and people in the industry have always kind of been drawn to you?
I don't know. It's the craziest thing to me. It's more crazy to me than about... Here's the thing. Why doesn't everybody speak honestly and openly? I don't understand that. People seem to like that in politics or horse racing or whatever the sport is. And, hey, we're all in it together. Without the player, we got no game. So we're all in it together.
You know, people will often ask me, what's Dale Romans really like? And I say, well, what you see is what you get. I mean, every week when you listen to that segment, that's Dale Romans. And, you know, and I think that's what makes you who you are.
Well, I appreciate that, and believe me, I love the fans out there in horse racing, and they've always been good to me from the time I won my first race, and I don't know, but I appreciate it.
You know, I describe you, though, Dale, as being humble, and people really take a step back and say, humble? He's always so outgoing and charismatic. I said, yeah, but don't confuse that for cockiness. He's always very humble. You kind of embrace your role as a public figure in the sport, but you almost kind of at times shy away from the attention that seems to come your way. Do you agree?
Well, you're the only one that seems to get me. Tammy says I'm attention hungry all the time, but I don't know. People come up to me, want to talk about horse racing. What are you going to do? I'll just talk to them. I don't care who you are. If you're a racing fan, you're my friend.
That's exactly the way it comes across, and that's what I try to tell people. Was it always like this for you? Were you the cool kid in school that everybody wanted to hang out with?
I had a lot of friends in high school. I never had a problem. I didn't talk a whole lot back then, believe it or not. People can't believe that. I was quiet, kind of introverted. And I don't know, after I got out in the world, I figured, why you got to be introverted? Let's just talk. And everybody's in the same boat. And just tell the truth, and everything will fall into place. And it's worked for me.
I cannot picture you being shy.
Yeah, back in high school days and grade school days, yeah, I kind of sulked behind my brother. He's only 17 months older than me. I was a little bit quiet back then, but I guess things have changed.
Well, I know people really enjoy.
I think I have a lot to say these days.
Yeah, well, and we're going to talk about that over the course of the next 50 minutes or so here on the show. But, you know, I think people really enjoy your honesty, your candidness, they enjoy the personality, all of that comes together. but they also enjoy watching your horses run. And you've got a good run, a good one running on Saturday in Cyclone Mischief, who goes in the Grade 3 Holy Bull Stakes. Still has a lot to prove, but you've been saying all along that this is a horse that has immense talent and a huge upside.
He really does. He's such a good horse. And let me tell you something, in horse racing, life is so much better when you're on the Derby trail. We've been fortunate enough to run 11 horses in Kentucky Derbies, and they get you up in the morning every day to get just to try to get there, first of all. It's such a fun puzzle to put together. But this horse literally has been one of the easiest ones, the easiest good horse I've trained maybe in my whole career. I mean, he is literally flawless. He has no soundness issues, no health issues that you have to worry about. You're always, you know, horses have come through the barn that every morning you walk in and hope they're okay. With him, you just walk in and expect him to be okay. And I'm telling you, he trained as well today as a horse could train.
Well, and he's going to have to run, you know, step up in his next race, too, in the Holy Bull. There are people that are saying, okay, the Holy Bull Stakes isn't all that strong of a race, so what does that really prove if he wins it? Man, you can only beat who you're in there with, right?
That's right, and you're not trying to prove anything right now. You're just trying to stay on the trail. You want him to keep doing good, keep progressing a little bit, pick up points. I mean, hopefully he wins, but it's a competitive race. But, you know, in the big picture of getting to the Kentucky Derby and winning it, the Holy Bull's probably not the most prestigious race along the trail, but it's a great spot for us. And he's a little different horse than I brought in the Derby in the past. So I always give him a little more time off between Churchill ending and getting him back on the path. I ran him in early January, and, you know, we're just going to keep him going. He's one of those horses. I say there's three types of horses I've had in my life. I said the ones you can really lean on and train hard on, and they'll melt. They just can't handle it. And then you've got the ones you can lean on and train hard, and they stay the same. They can handle it. But there's been a few of them. The more work you did, the better they got. And I feel like this is one of those horses. The more I can give him, the more I do with him, the better he seems to become. And
is
so
that
if
something?
I have to run all three spots down here, it may be something we do. I've never planned out a Derby trip that way to where you're going to hit the Holy Bull Fountain of Youth, Florida Derby. But I think this is the type of horse that could handle it and probably move forward from it.
Is that something, Dale, that you've learned after having started those other 11 horses and gone down this road with those horses for the Kentucky Derby? Or is this simply based on this horse and the workload that he simply seems to relish?
It has to be horse by horse. My theory on him is just simply this horse. He's a big, rugged, heavy-bodied horse with a lot of strength about him, and it seems like the more you do, the more athletic he becomes and the more he relishes what he's doing. And he can handle it. He eats all his food every day. As much as you can give him, he'll eat, and he just keeps going forward. So I've got high hopes for him. I don't think there's really been a standout show up yet, and I think that he's got as good a shot right now as anybody.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about giving him more to do and maybe even competing in all three races in Florida leading up to the Kentucky Derby, because it's an old school approach. We don't see horses run that much anymore. They come into the Kentucky Derby with three starts, maybe four starts, and that's considered to be a lot nowadays. Times have certainly changed, but it sounds to me like this is kind of a throwback type of horse.
He's an old school horse. He's a throwback, so we're going to put him in a throwback situation. The more I can train on him, the more we can run him, the better off he'll be.
Well, good luck in the Holy Bull this weekend. We'll see if he takes that next step and passes his next test. And that's all it is. Just pass the next test, survive in advance, go on to the next one, and just keep moving forward and try to peak on the first Saturday in May. How do you do that, Dale? If you're going to run him so much this spring, if that's the plan, you're going to give him that heavy workload, how do you make sure you leave something in the tank and get him to peak on the first Saturday in May if he gets there?
Well, it's a balancing act, and you know, you have to really monitor him. And after this race, I may change my mind. I may say, well, we'll skip the Fountain of Youth, or even skip like the Florida Derby and go into the Derby if he's run well off of his two preps. But we'll go race by race. But right now, it seems like he can handle a lot, and he thrives off a lot of work, and we'll just give him the work he needs.
How much does it bother you that you haven't won the Derby yet?
Well, I mean, when I started my career, if you just told me I started a horse in the Derby, I would have said, well, that's good enough to retire on. And now we've been fortunate enough to start 11, like I say. And it's hard to go these days when you don't have one in it. And I haven't missed a Derby since 1977 when I was 9 years old. But I don't know. I think about it all the time, and I can't really grasp what it would be like to be to win the Derby, to stand there on the pedestal, to take the trophy from one of my very best friends in life, Mark Bacon, that presents the trophy for Woodford Reserve, and stand up on that stage. I know we'd have a hell of a party that night in downtown Louisville.
Yeah, he'd have to make an extra Woodford Reserve for that party.
He saves me back a couple of bottles every year that I have one in it, just in those commemorative bottles in case we win it.
Which of those derbies that you came close a couple of times, Paddy O'Prado third, I remember Doolahan was third, Shackelford was fourth, which of those ones kind of sticks in your craw the most when you think back on it?
I tell everybody that with Shackelford taking the lead at the eighth pole, I know what it feels like to think you're going to win a derby. I haven't gotten to the fact that I know what it feels like to win it. But Shackelford, I mean, there's some horses. A medal count, if you go back and watch his race, he got in so much trouble, he could have been a lot closer. I think he was sixth or seventh. And Keen Ice. Keen Ice was in trouble the whole trip and ended up, you know, fifth or sixth and ran a big race. But Shackelford coming off the lead. And I'll tell you a story. Jesus Castanon rode him. And I had ridden Jesus, and he broke the maiden on Pat El Prado. He broke his the maiden of I can't think of his name right now, but I told him in the paddock of First Dude. He broke the maiden on First Dude.
Yeah.
I told him in the paddock for Shackelford. I said, we were 60-1 in the Florida Derby. And nobody really wanted to ride him. He hadn't shown himself yet. I told Jesus in there, I said, if you run big here, I will not take you off this horse no matter what. And he got beat ahead to dialed in. Our good friend Nick Zito. He was right that day I was wrong. and so we left him on him. But Jesus told me, he said, even when the Preakness was so big for him, because he stayed on to win the Preakness, he said, but coming off of that turn into the stretch on the lead in the Kentucky Derby, he said, you get hit with a wall of sound that you can't imagine, that he never expected. And it's almost like it hits you. And he said, that's the biggest thrill I've ever had in my career, is coming off of that turn on the lead in the Kentucky Derby, even bigger than going on and winning the Preakness.
Wow. Well, you know, I remember Mike Smith telling me once when I interviewed him before the Kentucky Derby a few years ago. He walked me through his win with Giacomo. And, Dale, he went step by step at every point in the race. But then he said that when he hit the finish line, he said there was this weird moment of silence that he got when he crossed the finish line. And then everything just exploded from there. When the sound came back for him, he said it almost knocked him off the horse. It was that type of yeah. powerful sound that he got and the roar from the crowd, and it was just unbelievable.
No, yeah, he's told me the same story, and it gives me chills even hearing it today from you.
Yeah.
And I tell everybody that they'll have to find a trainer for the Preakness, because I'll drop the mic if I ever won the Derby. That's it. But I'd probably keep going. Wayne Lucas says I'm full of it, and I'll keep right on going.
It'd just go out on top. That's it.
Yeah, go out on top. You know, John Elway, leave.
But, you know, your dad was such a big influence on you, and you know, he was, you know, a hardworking trainer, too. What do you think your dad would say if he could see all the success you've had?
You know, I don't know. You know how father and son dynamics are. He never said a whole lot to me, but then I run into all his friends and he talks about it. Because he got to see me be leading trainer one time at Churchill Downs before he passed away. He was only 58 when he died. And I run into all his friends that tell me now all the things, good things, positive, and how proud he was he would say to me. And I don't know. I wish he was here. I wish he would have seen all the great ones and the Breeders' Cups and Dubai World Cup and the Preakness. He never got to see any of that. He, like I said, he died at 58 of a rare blood disorder. And it's a good story, though. He's sitting in his hospital bed, and I'm head and head. I think I was one in front of Wayne. And where we came from, there was no plan on ever. He was leading train at Ellis Park. He was leading train at Turfway. But Churchill Downs was a whole different level. And I just remember that everybody's standing in the hospital room, and I'm leaving to go back to the racetrack, and he called me back in the room. He says, don't let him catch you. He says, you don't know how big it would be to be leading trainer at Churchill Downs.
Wow.
And we ended up tying for the thing. He was happy with that. He said, that's good enough. Me and Wayne tied. If you're going to tie with somebody, he said, Wayne's the best one in the world to tie with. And I thought about it today. I became the all-time leading trainer at Churchill. Since been passed, I will say. I'm now second. But I had it for a little while. And what you would have thought? Maybe an all-time leading trainer, Churchill now. Yeah. I think that would have been bigger to him. He grew up in Louisville. He started his career at right out of college. He didn't know anything about horses. Churchill Downs and Miles Park. It used to be a little racetrack in Louisville. And someday Roman's could have been the all-time winningest trainer there, I think would have blown him away. He was still in awe of the game. He came in. He wasn't born into it. He walked in out of college. He was very much still in awe of the game and the people at the top. And I think he would have been very proud.
No, I have no doubt. And we're talking about Dale's father, Jerry, and the success that he had as a trainer, winning more than 600 races in his career. And, you know, he kind of grinded it out with a lot of, you know, those claiming horses and the lower level horses. But he loved the game, and there's no doubt about it. Did you have a favorite horse of his that he trained, Dale, that you got to be around as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we didn't have very many good ones. I think the best horse he ever had was filly named Captain's Rose in the late 70s. He won a few little stakes around town and stuff, but there were all those old good horses. I claimed one that he trained for me when I was 15 years old, R. Pat Rooney. That was my favorite horse of all time, and an old throwback racehorse. I claimed him three different times, and he had a horse named Trigonero he claimed for about 15 or 20,000 and did real well with. He won a bunch of handicaps with a horse named Fieldhouse back in the 70s. That was the one he was most proud of. He liked the most. I think he claimed for 10,000. He won like five handicaps in a row up in New England when they had all those racetracks in New England. He'd always go up to like Narragansett, Rockingham, Green Mountain Park, Suffolk Downs. None of the tracks are even there anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was just a lot of fun. And, you know, he was leading trainer twice at Ellis Park and one or two times at Turfway. And he took a lot of pride in that. There used to be a race at Ellis Park. It was 2 1/4 miles. It was a twice around on a 1 1/8 racetrack. And it was a starter handicap that ran the last race of the meet every year. And he did whatever he could to try to have a horse to win that race. That was his Kentucky Derby. And he won it 3 or 4 times.
That's fantastic. I just went and pulled up his top horses here on Equibase, and his top earner all time was a horse called Count the Blues. Do you remember that one?
Oh yeah, Count the Blues was a good horse, and that was when I was actually working for him back then. It was owned by Frank Jones, which I still train for today, and probably the greatest unknown man in the game. And Count the Blues was a nice little horse.
Yeah, earned almost 300,000. So I mean, for a stable like that, that was, you know, kind of making their living with claiming horses, that's a lot of money.
You know, my father used to talk, that was a lot of money, but my father used to talk about success in this game, and he said, did you feed your family and did you stay in it for a long time? He said, you got to use that as a measure of success more than X's and O's and what races you won and didn't win. And that's always stuck in my mind. And he fed his family, and he made it all the way to the end of his life, but he died young. And, of course, Frank Jones, who was his main client, Frank was at the hospital the day I was born. He doesn't have any kids, and he's in his mid-80s today, and he's still the vice chairman of the Kentucky State Racing Commission, and he's had two trainers in 60 years, me and my father.
Wow. Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he was behind the two of us all the way. So whenever Count the Blues was one of the horses, when I first wanted to start going to Saratoga and I would start going south in the winter, first New Orleans, and then let's move to Florida, Frank Jones would always tell my father to pick out one or two horses for me to take on those road trips so I would have a horse I could win a race with. He's still
fantastic.
Taking care of me today.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, you mentioned your dad saying, you know, can you feed your family? Can you stay in it for a long time? This is not an easy profession, Dale. Let's not sugarcoat it. You've had a lot of success. You've won a lot of big races. We see a lot of trainers like Todd and Wayne and Nick Zito over the years, Steve Asmussen, that win these big races. But the majority of trainers are out there grinding it out, just trying to make a living. How does a trainer stay in this game for a long time? What's the key?
It's just tough. It is. It's a tough goal. I'll tell everybody, all these kids that come into the game, especially some of them from their owner's children, I said, believe me, this is a better hobby than it is career choice. It's too tough. It is too tough. And I don't know. It's every day you get up and work. Every day you get up and do what you can do just to stay in the game. But there's so many variables. I was playing golf with basketball coach one day, and he said, "You got the same problem I do. We have all the responsibilities and very few of the controls." Right. And that's what you got to have. But you got to have a lot of luck, and you got to be consistent. You got to show up every day. You got to be honest with people. Do what you can do to grind out some wins. But it is, what have you done for me lately, sport.
You know, the game's changed so much, too. And now with, you know, HISA and the legislation, all these different things that are taking place in our sport that are making headlines. Do you think, Dale, if you were just starting out today, do you think you'd make the same decision to go ahead and be a horse trainer today, knowing that, you know, this is the environment you're getting into?
Well, I'm pretty sure I would. I think about it, some of the young kids coming up, because there's so many good young trainers behind us, and they're really making an impact on the game. We talk about it every week on our show. But I think it would be easier to step into today's world than it would be to come up through the old days and do it the way we used to do it into today's world. I think that the guys that kind of grew up in the game and did it a certain way for so long are going to have more trouble converting to the new systems and the new ways of doing things. But with that being said, there was one time, you know, Alan Jerkins was one of my great mentors and one of my closest friends. And I don't know, I lost a couple of races and a couple of horses races didn't go. And Alan and I would always meet up at the barn at feed time in the afternoons. And we would sit in his golf cart. His barn was next to mine. We'd drive around and just talk. And I was whining one day, and Alan pulled me up. He said, "Listen, I'm 82 years old. I started training when I was 17. The game's changed ever since I started all the time. Either change with it or get out. I don't want to hear it," and kick me off the golf cart.
It's so Alan Jerkins.
Stuck in my mind all this time. But, hey, you better be willing to change with it or you got to go.
Yeah, it's like that with any sport, though, right? I mean, rules
it's
in the NFL
sport,
are changing.
Industry,
baseball,
sport,
it doesn't matter.
Any industry, any business, do not get complacent and stuck in your ways. Be willing to change. And that's what we're having this problem with HISA. HISA is not a big problem in my mind. I mean, of course, I'm against the federal government being involved in almost anything we do. Except for now, HISA is here. It's a federal law. And I wrote the op-ed last week asking people, let's just try to get together and make it as good as we possibly can and fix it. And I think with Lisa Lazarus running the operation, she's shown that she's willing to work with everybody and work with the horsemen and get it right. This thing's going to be around for the next 100 years. Hopefully horse racing's thriving that long. And it's time for us to quit fighting with one another and just figure out which rules need to be tweaked, changed. She's done everything I've asked her to do. She put together an advisory board of horsemen. She put the National HBPA president on that advisory board. And she's shown her willingness to listen to what we say and fix the problems that we have. So it's not going anywhere. So I think it's time for us to start working with them and get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing now, and organizations like the HBPA are, you know, obviously opposed to HISA because of the fact that they think that some of the language in there is unconstitutional. And the way that the whole thing was put together is unconstitutional. They're not necessarily opposed to some of the things that the organization is going to try to do to help horse racing, but they're concerned about the constitutionality of it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with it, and that's where I'm kind of a bridge in the middle, it seems like. I like both sides, and I agree with certain things on each side, but I disagree with a lot of things. And I keep telling them, I said, the National HPBA fighting you and trying to make this thing constitutional is only going to make it stronger in the end, because they're going to be forced to do it right.
Yeah.
And you know what we need? 95% of the people, the detractors and the people worrying about the federal government being involved is federal funding. We need somebody. You know, they did mandate that we use this system to regulate ourselves, but they didn't give us any money to do it. It's a $60 billion economic impact on the United States, our horse industry. And we only need $50 to $100 million a year to operate it. That's a pretty good return on investment. So I think the thing that HISA needs to be doing is they need to have their lobbyists, they need to be in Capitol Hill trying to get $50 to $100 million a year so that we can regulate our business and make that impact on the United States. If we got federal funding, I think you would lose a lot of detractors.
It always comes down to money, right? And that was one of the big sticking points with the legislation when it was first, you know, put forth and made it through and became law. A lot of horsemen and racetracks and racing officials were saying, "Hey, wait a minute, something isn't right here. Who the hell's paying for this thing? And it that was at its crux. That's what everybody's upset about right now.
Yep, that's the biggest issue. That's the biggest sticking point, because why does it matter who regulates us? If it's the state of Kentucky or if it's the federal government, we're all going to be regulated. And maybe we need to come into the 21st century of regulation, but we need to find a way to fund it. So anybody out there that likes horse racing and contributes to that $60 billion economic impact, let's get a hold of your congressman and let them know. Give us a little bit of money. It's not that much. It's less than the cost of sending the missiles to Ukraine. I mean, to get them there, not much less shoot them off. And we'll bring back a lot of money for the federal government and for the United States people that work in our game.
Talking with Trainer Dale Romans here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. I started the show by telling you that you can catch Dale, and so many of you have, catch Dale every single Saturday along with his sidekick Tim Wilkin on I Ask, They Answer, which airs at 10:30 Eastern every Saturday morning on our Equine Forum show. Dale, one thing you just brought up, you mentioned that when you talked with Alan Jerkins, he said, hey, either adapt and evolve and change the way you do business or get out of the game. How much have you changed since you first got into the sport now? How much are you a different trainer than you were back then?
Oh, I'm much different. I'm much different. You know, when you're young, you got the youthful enthusiasm. And later on, you have age and wisdom. And you don't quite get as upset about little things as you used to. And you understand it's more about the horse. Who's got the fastest horse? And that's why I keep telling you all, we talk about all these polls and statistics. And so the bottom line is line them up and see who's the fastest of the wire. But a lot of things have changed. But more than anything is the intensity, I think. And you realize things are going to happen every day. You just got to get out there and deal with it. And when I was young, I would come to the barn every morning just waiting for that day that I would have a perfect morning. No horse was injured. No horse, every horse ate up. Nobody had a temperature. Nobody was coughing. It ain't happened in 40 years. So I finally decided it ain't going to happen. I quit waiting for it.
Yeah,
but the other thing, electronics. Electronics have changed the game as much as anybody. You know, I used to run to the newsstand to get the newspaper to see the results in New York or California. And everything is instant gratification right now. And I think our game is made for this, the Internet, and for instant gratification.
Yeah, so many ways for fans and horsemen to keep in touch with each other and to get the sport out there. And we're doing that here on Trainer Talk on this edition here this afternoon. Dale Romans is with me. Dale, stay with me. I have to get to a short commercial break. We'll come back and talk about more of those memories in your career. I'll let you tell a few more stories. We'll do it all next in the second half of the program. It is Trainer Talk, and it is presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Phasic Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, featuring stakes caliber racing and broodmare prospects, mares in foal to the nation's top sires, and a large selection of short yearlings. Recent graduates include Grade 1 winners Leave No Trace and Hot Rod Charlie, plus graded stakes winners Actuator and Adair Manor. The last mixed sale before the start of the breeding season, Kentucky Winter Mixed, February 6th and 7th at Phasic Tipton in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
There's plenty of thrills at Gulfstream Park during the championship meet, with live racing Wednesday through Sunday. Don't miss the Triple Crown prep races, including the Fountain of Youth on March 4th and Florida Derby on April 1st. Enjoy the races outdoors from Carousel Club, or feast in 10 Palms, offering a premium view of the races. For stakes schedules, reservations, and tickets, visit GulfstreamPark.com.
This proven son of Giants Causeway has sired 7 millionaires. With over 10% stakes performers, his recent top runners include Tarabi, placed in the Grade 1 Spinaway and Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies, Grade 2 winner Plum Ali, multi-millionaire Shivaji, plus these standout performers. Now his biggest book in the past decade will be three-year-olds in 2022. A proven value sire, First Samurai, standing at Claiborne Farm.
Attention horsemen, make plans now to race at Woodbine in 2023. The Thoroughbred meet begins in April and Woodbine will distribute more than $64 million in purses. Plus, you'll enjoy world-class racing and training facilities with top turf racing in North America over the prestigious E.P. Taylor Turf Course. Woodbine's convenient proximity to Kentucky and New York, along with a 9-month racing season, make it the perfect place to compete this year. Shipping incentives may be available, so don't delay. Contact Director of Racing Tim Lawson today and visit woodbine.com for more information.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Magistretti, who is in control, targeted now on the outside by Kitten's Joy, kicking Chris right there in behind, and Tycoon is ready to roll, and the field turns for home, and Magistretti now accelerating. Magistretti opens up, the lead is a length, Kitten's Joy set down for the drive, and here he comes now. Oh, and he's got plenty of run. Kitten's Joy taking the lead with an impressive turn of foot. Oh my! Kitten's Joy just blowing Magistretti away in Tycoon. Oh, this is a very good three-year-old. Kitten's Joy wins by three emphatic lengths. Magistretti was second, and Tycoon was third. Father Back Request for Parole was fourth.
Yeah, very good three-year-old indeed. He was very, very good with Kitten's Joy. He earned over $2 million in his career. And that huge win 19 years ago in the 2004 Joe Hirsch Turf Classic, the legendary Tom Durkin with the call, one of the great calls in all of Tom's career. There were so many good ones, but that certainly stands out too. And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with Kitten's Joy trainer Dale Romans, and Kitten's Joy, just one of several greatest stakes winners conditioned by Dale. We talked about Cyclone Mischief going in the Grade 3 Holy Bull Stakes this weekend at Gulfstream for Dale, hoping to add another greatest stakes to his resume. We'll find out if Cyclone Mischief can pass that test, but I'll talk more with Dale in just a second, but I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of the show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast at your leisure. You can also do that on every major podcast platform. So however you get your podcast, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Google, whatever it is, just type in Horse Racing Radio Network, and you can listen to all of our shows, including this one, at your leisure. Well, Dale, that little trip down memory lane for you, how cool was that? What was going through your mind listening to Tom call the Joe Hirsch?
You know, that was one of my favorite calls of all time. And I tell Tom that all the time. And like you said, it was one of his great calls. It yep. did look like Magistretti coming off the turn was going to win. Kitten's Joy was such a special horse, though. And that was the first time that Johnny Velasquez rode him. And because if you remember, Jerry Bailey fell off a ladder down in Florida here putting on storm shutters to his house and broke his arm.
Yeah.
And he had been riding him. And I told Johnny in the paddock then, I said, Johnny, this horse, we want to get him ready to go the mile and a half in the Breeders' Cup. I just want you to sit. I said, when you sit, think you've sat too long, I want you to sit a little bit longer. And when you uncock your stick, grab a handful of mane so you don't fall off the back of this big chestnut son of a gun. He's going to be rolling. And he did, and he did, and he did. He watched, he turns his stick over and hit him one time, and he exploded past Magistretti, which is a great horse, trained by Patrick Biancone. And so you want to hear a little side story. Patrick and I are very good friends, and Patrick calls me when we go to Dallas for the Breeders' Cup. That was the next start, and he was the favorite, and I was second choice. And Patrick calls and he says, we're in good shape. He said, I talked to the stall man. We're going to be in the barn together. We'll have, we can share the night watchman. And he said, and Mr. Tabor said we could play golf every day at the Four Seasons. We'll make a holiday out of it. And I said, we can make a holiday out of it, Patrick, but you're the favorite and I'm second choice. I'd have to hire two night watchmen to watch your one. And I called the stall man. I said, get me as far from the Frenchman as you can. And so they put us in separate barns, but we did play golf at the Four Seasons. Thank you, Mr. Tabor. And we had a great week, and we ran second and third. I believe he was third, Magistretti. And Better Talk Now got us that day.
Yeah.
After a 20-minute inquiry, I still believe that Better Talk Now should have come down, but my good friend Graham argues with me every time we're out to dinner or something.
You know, that camaraderie that you have, and we started talking about, you know, the way people love you because you're so honest and your personality, all these different things that come through on the show every week with us on the Equine Forum. But that camaraderie, Dale, that you have with guys like Nick Zito, Graham Motion, Patrick Biancone, you just mentioned, Wayne Lucas, that's something that is it's really unique, isn't it?
That's the highlight of my life. That's as important to me as winning races, is that these guys that think like I do, that grew up with me, that are either or that I grew up idolizing, are my friends. And I said it one night at a Derby trainers dinner. I said, the greatest fraternity in my mind in the world is the fraternity of horse trainers. And we might fight with one another, but nobody on the outside is going to come in and fight with any of us. We can argue about the game. We can bitch and moan about things that happen. But at the end of the day, we're brothers in war. And it's the only industry in the world where you stand next to your best friend that you're trying to beat that afternoon and take food off his table.
Yeah.
But that, you know, I'm a first and foremost a racing fan. I've never been a big gambler, but I'm just a racing fan. And it really is, to me, strange that I can grow up and hang out with the guys I idolized as a kid.
You know, I chose Kitten's Joy there because I know you've talked about it many times on the show, that Kitten Joy was a horse that really put you on the map and got you started and meant so much to you and to your career. So spend just another minute or two reflecting upon Kitten's Joy and what he did mean to you.
Well, Kitten's Joy breathed different air than anything I've ever been around. I swear he could do simple math. He was the smartest horse I've ever around. If I wanted him to go out and work him in 52, he'd work in 52. If I wanted to work in 47, he'd work in 47. If I wanted to put him on a lead in a race, he'd be on a lead. If you wanted to bring him from last, he'd come from last. But it's a funny story. He and Rose DeMay came to me on the same day. Neither one of them had ever started. Neither one of them were really highly thought of. And I put them in a stall side by side. As smart as Kitten's Joy was, and as easy as he was to deal with, Rose DeMay was total opposite. He would eat you alive. He would bite you. He was tough to gallop. He'd get out in races. He had quarter cracks in his feet he had to deal with. Something going on all the time with him. He would just eat people alive. And Ken, I swear Kitten's Joy would stand out his head out of the stall and just look at him and say, like, what are you doing? Why do you act like that? But those two horses changed my life. One of them made $5.5 million, the other one made $2 million as champion. It was just a funny contrast. And they would ship around the country together. Cause like, they went to Breeders' Cups together. They went all over the place together. And I believe that they became friends. But, yeah, you can almost see Kitten Story look over at the stall next to him, just shake his head at how Roses would act all the time. But I would go back to the barn at night and watch Kitten's Joy in the stall, and it was just like watching Fred Astaire move. He was just watching him walk around the stall was different than anything I'd ever been around. And he was just a fabulous, fabulous racehorse. And he had a major impact in the breed. I mean, he's been a great stallion. And at the end of the day, it came down to Ken Ramsey choosing to pick one or the other. You either keep Kitten's Joy and make him a stallion and sell Roses, or you keep Roses and sell Kitten's Joy. My recommendation was to keep Kitten's Joy, and he really couldn't believe that I said that because he was a grass horse in this country. I said, but you don't understand the class difference. Kitten was just all class through and through. A five-year-old could walk him around the barn. One day, I remember I bringing him off the layoff, and I ran him in the firecracker, and my good friend Robbie Alvarado was in the race. And Robbie said if Kitten's Joy went by him so fast, he said he cut himself for about five strides not riding, just watching him run. And I thought that was the ultimate compliment.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
no doubt.
One day at the track, I had him walking around the barn, and Robbie came to him in the morning. He was just walking under tack, and he hadn't gone out yet. He said, leg me up. And he rode him a couple of laps around the shed. He jumped off. He said, now I can say I rode the great Kitten's Joy. He never left the barn, but he rode him around the shed row.
I love it. I mean, those horses, Kitten's Joy, Roses in May, so special to you. But there have been so many others. And, you know, we're going to leave some out if we start talking about everyone individually. But I do want to bring up a couple. Horses like Shackelford, who you mentioned earlier, and Little Mike, and, you know, Silver Max and Keen Ice. I mean, Doolahan, those were such tough, hard-knocking horses that you had the privilege to be around. When you think back on all the good ones, Dale, what are some of the ones that really do jump off the page to you?
Little Mike's a good one to talk about. I mean, we could sit here all day. We could make two or three shows if you want one day with just talking about this stuff. But Little Mike was the little engine that could. I mean, he's by a $500 stallion. They gave the owner the mare when he bred him. and not a horse you would ever buy. I always said little Mike made me feel dumb at a sale because I would have never bought him. His legs weren't straightest in the world. He was very wide. He was a little bitty narrow thing, but he was just a little engine that could. And, you know, we decided to run. He was only considered he could only be a miler because he was so fast and he would go lead. And we decided to try him in a mile and a quarter in LA Chameleon. It's one of the greatest races out there. I'd run second with Kitten's Joy. But one of the races I really wanted on my resume. And he went out there with Ramon Dominguez and went wire to wire and won the thing. So we're going to the Breeders' Cup. Everybody said it was a fluke, you know, that he could get a mile and a quarter. It was one time because nobody thought he could do it, so they let him alone on the lead, da-da-da-da-da. So we were going to go back and run in the Breeders' Cup mile in Santa Anita. And a couple of days before the race, Carlo and I started looking at horses. You know, we got to run against Wise Dan. I don't know we can beat Wise Dan. I don't know that he's just too good. It's kind of so we decided to run him a mile and a half in the Breeders' Cup. The entries come out, and I don't remember the horse's name, but Todd had a horse in there that was really fast, and Joe Bravo was riding. And Joe had ridden little Mike so much, he knew, at least he thought he knew, that we were going to go to the lead. And I knew, I said, Joe's going to send out there and hook us going a mile and a half. We cannot win on the lead. So when we go in the paddock, I tell Ramon, I said, Ramon, you're not going to believe this, but I want you to lay third. There's two fast horses. Just sit behind them. But act like you're on the lead. Ride like you're on the lead because I think they'll stop. And you'll inherit the lead at the eighth pole. And then you just got to ride your ass off from the eighth pole to wire. And if you go back and watch, it may be the greatest race any jockey ever rode in his life. And Ramon did just what we said. The two horses, not very often you could draw it up, and I don't give many instructions to jockeys. But that one just seemed so clear to me. And it's just the way we drew it up. He inherited his lead at the eighth pole, and here comes Sugar Horse, the favorite, flying on the outside, and he doesn't get to us, and we win going a mile and a half. And I think it was one of Ramon's greatest races. And I think I've told this story on here before, but so fast forward, Ramon gets hurt, Ramon retires, and he's still a good friend. And we're at Saratoga one day, and Saratoga had this big thing. They brought in all these Hall of Fame jockeys, almost every living Hall of Fame jockey they brought in for that afternoon.
Yeah.
And I came out of the races, and I'm going to the parking lot, and Ramon's standing there, and I go over and talk to him. He's like a kid in a candy store telling me, he says, you won't believe what I was doing. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm hanging out with Georgie Velasquez, Angel Cordero, Lafitte Pinkai, Jacinto Vasquez. We're all over there. They're telling me all these stories. I said, you silly son of a gun. Do you not realize, here's how humble he is, this guy. I said, you not realize that you're ever been as good as ever one of them and better than most that you just talked to and hung out with?
Yeah.
And he looked at me like he does sometimes, Ramon. He hesitated before he said anything. He said, I think you're biased because we did something special together.
Yeah, he is truly one of the great people, human beings in the sport of thoroughbred racing. I'm glad he's still involved. I'm glad you still see Ramon Dominguez around the racetrack because, you know, he's one of those guys that if racing didn't have him around, it would be a massive, massive loss.
Racing is always better with guys like Ramon involved.
Yep. Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, by the way, visiting with trainer Dale Romans here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton, kind of going down memory lane, remembering some of the top horses and some of the moments that surrounded those horses. And Dale, I was looking this up and I was blown away that this, and I'm going to bring something up that you probably don't want public, but we're going to make it unpublic on Saturday. You're entering a third year now without winning a graded stakes race, which is unfathomable. It's mind-blowing. How challenging have these past couple of years been for you, both personally and professionally even?
You know how I look at it? I look at it as unfathomable that I've won 200 greatest stakes or whatever it is. And so if I took a little couple of years off from not doing it, that's all right. We'll bounce back. We're going to win us some few. If I don't ever win another one, I've gotten more than most people or more than I ever thought I would in my life. So I just go out there every day. You're a victim of your yearling crop every year, and so even though it sounds like a long period of time, it's only a couple of sales that you haven't come out with a top one. And but I think this year we're on the verge of having a really good year. We might win a few this year and maybe a few grade ones and maybe a classic.
Yeah, you know, you can't keep a good man down, and that's certainly the motto that surrounds you right now. You also made some changes personally in your life, and Dale, I saw a picture of you the other day and I thought I was looking at a jockey. You've lost so much weight. You look great.
Yeah, I had gastric sleeve surgery. I got up to almost 400 pounds, and I said, damn, I got to do something. I had gastric sleeve surgery. A couple of friends of mine had it done, and it worked well for them, and they were all pushing me to go give it a shot, and it's the best thing ever happened to me. I've lost 150 pounds and quit drinking. I feel good and energized again, so hopefully it pays off in business, too.
Yeah, well, I think it has to. You know, I received an email when we announced that you were going to be joining me here on the show, and it came from somebody we both know, Bob Kiekeffer, who writes for the UPI. He's a turf writer for them. And he said, you know, if you want a sad chuckle from Dale, ask him about finding a new way to lose after all of the ones that he's lost over the years. On Saturday in the second race at Gulfstream, he said something happened that Dale has never had happen to him before. So, Dale, tell me that story.
Yeah, that was when I told him when we were after the race, I said I thought I knew every way in the world it was to lose. This was a new one. The buckle on the stirrup webbing gave way and unbuckled, and the jock had no stirrup to put his foot in. He's lucky he didn't kill himself and fall off. And that, I mean, let me explain to everybody. That's not my tack. The jockeys own it. The jockeys maintain it for obvious reasons. It's all on them for safety. And the buckle came undone, and Junior Alvarado literally almost fell off the horse and had to gallop him around there like an Indian, sitting flat on his back and just pulling him up. I said, well, damn, that's another way to lose. Chalk it up.
I
went on to win a $3 million race. I mean, how bad would it have been if he came off and had a little injury or something?
Right. I can imagine that. I mean, you see something like that happen, and, you know, you've been in this game a long time, and you have to, like, take a step back and say, you have to be kidding me. There's no way that we could possibly lose any other way than what I've done in the past.
And I really like the horse. He's a really good horse, Kentucky Joker, Calumet horse. I just shook my head. You can't get mad. I mean, things happen. What are you going to do? And I think Junior thought I was going to be really mad when he came back. He said, man, I'm just glad you're safe. We'll reload. We'll run again in a couple of weeks and see what happens. But, yeah, that found a new way to lose.
Yeah, that has to be so frustrating for a trainer, too, because, you know, you do everything right with the horse. You get a horse you like. You bring him into the race the right way. You think he's ready to go. And then something completely out of your control happens. How do you deal with that?
It's not easy a lot of times. That's what I was talking about earlier. 30 years ago, I'd have lost my mind. But nowadays, you learn to deal with the things you can change. And what's the serenity prayer? And
yeah. Yeah,
and not worry about the things you can't, and don't and give me the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah. I mean, time has certainly changed Dale Romans, but it has for every trainer too. I remember Bob Baffert talking to me about that when I interviewed him before the Kentucky Derby a few years ago, and he talked about being a totally different trainer now than when he first came over from quarter horses. And I think it's just natural with anybody that does something for so long. You look at things differently. You don't get as upset over things that used to kind of bother you and get under your skin, and you just kind of handle things in a more professional fashion.
Yeah, it's just wasted time, and there's no reason to do it. It takes a long time to learn it. But I think one of the greatest lines Bob ever had, when he started really doing good and winning races, and some reporter asked him what he had done differently, he said he changed his feed program. And he said, oh, yeah, what did you change to? He said, I started feeding faster horses.
That makes a difference. Well, yeah. Okay, let's take that for a second then, Dale, because I've said this many times on the show that a horse trainer, just like a coach, right, in any sport, is only as good as their players. So if you don't have the players, it's hard to win.
It is. It's hard. You got to, you got to have the people to work with, the horses to work with. It's like, just like you say, any coach. You got to have good players, and if we don't have a player, you can only do so much. You can only make them run so fast, you know. But like Wayne told me years ago, he earned the right to train the horses he trains, and we can get in their way. I think more times than not, we get in their way and cause them to be losers more than we make them winners. You learn that as you get older too. Best thing to do is just get them fit and happy, and stay out of their way.
Yeah, happy horses. Just keep them happy and let them do their thing.
Exactly.
If you could, Dale, I'm going to give you three choices here. Well, I'll let you choose them. But if you could pick three trainers, not just modern-day trainers, but any trainer in the history of the sport, and you could trade places with them for a day, what three trainers are you going to choose?
Woody Sears, Leroy Jolly, and Alan Jerkins.
How come?
Because they're old school. They knew the game when it was at its greatest. It was a different world back then. And I worked for Woody when I was a kid for a little while. I never got friendly with Woody. I was too young. He was too much on a pedestal for me to be nerve enough to go talk to a lot. But Alan and Leroy became great friends of mine. And it just seemed like the life they lived was different than the trainer lives today. And it would have been interesting to be able to step in their shoes for 24 hours. But they both became very good friends. And that's also a highlight of my life. I tell you, when I won the Travers with Keen Ice and we beat American Pharoah, Leroy Jolly was down to two horses, and he had him. I gave him two of my stalls in my barn because I wanted him with me. And when I walked back with the horse, the man standing in the barn was my hero growing up, Leroy Jolly, to give me a hug and congratulations and welcome to the Travers Club.
Wow.
So those guys would be my picks. Those were my heroes growing up, the ones I looked up to the most.
Do you now, at this point in your career, look at yourself as being that guy that maybe some young kid is looking up to and that you have a responsibility now to take other trainers, young trainers, under your wing and kind of help them a little bit?
You know, the older guys are so good to me. I try to help these younger guys and try to be good to them. I haven't found many of them that needed much help, though. These guys are wicked smart in today's world. But I'll tell you a good story about that. One day at Saratoga, I got too many stories. We could go on forever. But one day at Saratoga, it was me and Tony Dutrow and Rick Dutrow and Angel Cordero and another guy. We went to the golf course at Saratoga National for lunch. And, of course, we're all heroes of Angel. And we get him telling stories, and we start talking about it. I start talking about the first time I saw Seattle Slough. And getting to ride in a limousine with Billy Turner and listen to his stories about him. And that they both start talking about Dutrow's, about their father and Buddy Delph and King Leatherberry around Maryland in the day. And we were just like kids again, just loving horse racing and talking about how we grew up in the game and what it meant to us. So we're walking out, and Tony put his arm around me when we were leaving. He said, and Tony had won the Alabama, and I won the Travers. And Tony put his arm on me. He said, you think there's any kids looking up to us the way we did all those guys coming up? And I said, I don't know, but I hope so.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. And I think just based on the response we're getting from folks that enjoy you every Saturday morning on I Ask, They Answer with Timmy, I think there's a lot of people that look up to Dale Romans and the way that you've handled yourself throughout your career, Dale. So kudos to you. If Dale Romans was going to create a bucket list of things you still want to accomplish, obviously the Kentucky Derby is at the top of the list, but what are some of the other things in the sport that you haven't done that you would love to accomplish?
Well, Kentucky Derby's number one, of course. I would say Belmont would be number two, and that would give me the whole Triple Crown. I'd love to win a Breeders' Cup Classic. I think I love that race, too. I think the Breeders' Cup's done great things for horse racing. But I think when it's all said and done, it's over. I hope people can look back and say, I left the game better than I found it, and I had a little bit of contribution to it.
Mm. Well, that leads me into my next question, then. What do you think you're most proud of when you think back on your career and everything that you've done?
Longevity and able to feed my family.
The advice from your father.
The advice from my father. To how to measure success.
Yeah. You know, spend a minute. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show. Spend a couple minutes talking about your family. And I know you're a wonderful family man, and I know that they mean the world to you, obviously. But spend a few minutes. They're obviously actively involved in the business, and they love being around Dad and the horses. So tell me more about your family.
Yeah, well, Tammy's sitting right here with me. I mean, we're like Mutt and Jeff. I'm 6'4", she's 4'6". Everybody knows us wherever we go. But we don't get very far apart. And, you know, I come from a racing family. My father, her father was a jockey and a trainer. Her brother was a great jockey. Rode 49er and the Naira Mile at one time, people might remember. And then our kids come along, and neither one of them wanted to work in the barn. Our daughter's just turned 30 last week, and she works in politics in Washington, D.C., and is a fitness instructor and yoga instructor and loves the game from a little bit of a distance. He's always here for the big races and supportive and keeping track. And then my son Jacob, he grew up loving horse racing. I tell everybody there's a difference in loving horses and loving horse racing. was too keen on getting up early and going to clean the stall or taking care of a horse. He liked coming around the barn and going to the big races, and he loved horse racing. So the perfect game for him was to be a jockey's agent. He's done a wonderful job. He helps me a lot with figuring out where to go and what races to run in. And he's got Joe Talamo and Martin Garcia at Oakland Park, two good riders. And it's been fun to watch him blaze his own trail. And some of my good friends that come up to me that have worked with him tell me how good a job he's done, and that he's got a right perspective on the game coming from a trainer. I think being a trainer's son, a little different than somebody just came off the streets and became a jockey's agent. He understands the trainer's way of thinking, and I think it's helped him a lot in the game. And I'm proud of both of them and what the game's allowed me to do for my kids and my family.
Jake also has another claim to fame. He has a piece of an Eclipse Award.
He was your first Eclipse Award you ever won, Jake, and another little kid. I think they were 10 years old, did the handicapping for your Breeders' Cup. So, yeah, he can claim it. Every once in a while, when they're all giving me grief, I carry my Eclipse roller around the house just to let them know who the boss is. And they don't seem very impressed, but he always tells me, I got a little piece of one of those.
Jake and Abby Huffman, kid capping.
Yes.
Yep.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And, yeah, I'm so glad to have to see him having all of his success now and doing well as an agent, and I hope he keeps that ball rolling too. Down to about 2 minutes left, Dale, so I always like to end the show by asking trainers to let us know something about them we haven't talked about yet. So any other sports you follow, hobbies, anything else that Dale Romans enjoys doing outside of racing, what might they be?
I'm one of the worst happy golfers in the world. I like to play a lot of golf. Football was my game. I was a good football player in high school and all through grade school and high school.
What position?
I played center and tackle on one of the better programs in the state of Kentucky, Butler High School, one of the few public schools to win two state championships. But I could have played at Morehead State when I was a kid, but then they looked at my transcripts and said, you need to be a horse trainer. And so if it wasn't for horse training, I think football might have been my gig. I think I could have seen myself being a football coach somewhere. But I love that. I love that game. And I like all games. Of course, you'd have to like Kentucky and Louisville basketball. If you're from the state of Kentucky, you better like basketball. But I can only jump about 2 inches, so that wasn't going to ever work out. So I found my sweet spot in sports and feel like I've been where I belonged all along.
Yeah, well, you've got a pretty good sweet spot on the radio, too. And I know so many people that are listening listen to you on Saturday morning. They can do it again this Saturday morning, 10:30 Eastern, with Timmy Wilkin. I ask, they answer. Dale, listen, this has been a delight to kind of take a trip down memory lane and hear some of your thoughts on the sport and you know, hear some of those stories. We'll do it again soon, but I really appreciate it here this afternoon, bud.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me, and thank you for what you and your team do for the sport, getting it out there.
All right, say hi to Tammy. Good luck this weekend.
All right. Talk to you later.
That's Dale Romans. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. If you missed any portion of the show, and it was a good one, head back, check out the podcast, horseracingradio.net, and you can also do that on every major podcast platform. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, for my special guest, Dale Romans, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to another edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.